Do you want to do it over here?
Oh, let's go sit down. Not the one.
No.
I'm not the one.
But I should do...
Have you done this yet?
No.
I didn't even know this. As I'm listening to this, I'm going, holy macaroni, there's a book in here.
I know. With all my friends and people say, you really should do a book sometime, Maddie. And I talk it best, like, for me to actually try and
get this. There's no way.
Yeah, you can't. You got to do this.
Because once the stories start rolling...
Yes, you got to do this.
Yeah.
And then once it's down, you may not even be the one to write. You may have to find a writer that can ghost it for you and just write it all down. Right? You have all photos and all that kind of stuff as well. Right from the beginning?
Mm-hmm.
From way back?
Black and white's me playing bongos and... my little cowboy outfit and all that stuff, you know. The old record player. And yeah, my parents had a lot of music. You know, my mom, she liked Frank Sinatra and Tom Jones and that stuff. She liked the Western too, but she liked a little bit more of the jazzy feel and that. And so there was a great blend of music in the house. And, of course, when I started a marching band in South Vancouver, it wasn't through the high school, it was through the community center, Killarney Community Center. And my parents were in there. They did, you know, the chaperone when we would go to the Penticton Peach Festival or Seattle Sea Fair, or the PNE, Calgary Stampede. You know, we were a traveling marching band and co-ed. It was girls and boys. And I learned all my rudiments and my, you know, my early snare drum work from those years. And
Were you self-taught? Did you
I was self-taught. And I learned to read a little bit because we had sheet music in the marching band. Mm. So the bandmaster, you know, we learned that. But it was one of those sort of natural abilities that my parents really nurtured and, you know. And it was probably my dad living through me as his dream to be an entertainer. I mean, he came across Canada in the boxcars from Quebec.
Oh.
You know, we didn't even speak English and with his brother during the Depression, and he had a guitar on his back. So his common denominator was music with people. So he would friend people with his guitar playing and his French-Canadian folk songs. Talk about the rivers and sing about all the French-Canadian stuff, right? And then as he met people in Alberta, because the work was out west. So, you know, that spirit of that, you know, lived in our family as we grew up in Surrey, where we started first, and then we moved to South Vancouver during my grade 6 year, because it was too far for Dad to commute to work now. And those days, there was hardly any traffic on the roads, but he didn't want to have to drive that far, because he worked in the city, and Mom worked at Williams Moving and Storage. So, you know, music, once the marching band thing started, then I had, you know, discipline. But I was always playing to music, and my dad built me a soundproof room in the basement of the house in South Vancouver.
How old were you then?
So what are you when you're in grade 6? You're 11? 12?
Yeah.
So by the time I was 12, I had my own room in the basement. It was a four-level house on Killarney Park, and it was corked down so I could... I'll tell you the story how I got my first set of drums. So I started out with a rental snare drum. It was just a snare drum. I took marimba lessons for 1 year and learned to read and music and that. But it wasn't really my thing. And then Dad rented me a snare drum from Pamis Music on Canby Street. So I had a snare drum in my room and I had a record player. And one day my dad was doing a floor laying job in tile, a bathroom in a gentleman's house who was a retired drummer. He was a swing band drummer that used to play the old Commodore Ballroom and Izzy Supper Clubs and The Cave back in the early days in Vancouver nightclub scene. And the drums were in the basement with a sheet over top of them. He was retired. My dad was taking his tools, his cement and his trowels and all his tools to do the work in the house to the basement. And he saw this set of drums under there and he asked the old man, said, "So, see some drums downstairs, you know, what's with the drum kit?" He says, "Oh, I was a retired jazz drummer, and I don't play anymore now, but they're down there collecting dust." And my dad said, "Would you be interested in selling them?" This is how the story goes anyway. And he said, "You know, for the right price." And he said, "Well, how about if I do the bathroom and the kitchen for the set of drums?" And he said, "You got yourself a deal." So when I came home from school in grade 7 in South Vancouver, the drums were in the living room, and the old jazz drummer was there, and my dad and my mom, And because I always got home from school a bit late because I had after, I always played soccer and stuff like that. And there were these, a full set of drums. It was the first, my first drum kit. And he gave me my first lesson right in the living room. And then he left and we set them up in my bedroom and I could play my heart's content down there. And all you'd hear was this muffled, you know, because Dad corked the roof and the ceiling and he did all the insulation in there. And, wow. You know, they wanted me to have a place that I could play in.
So he must be just have been incredibly proud of you.
Yeah.
As he saw you evolve with the band.
Absolutely. And my mother too, but my mom died young when after I'd left school a couple of years. Mm. My mom got cancer in 1975. Mm. And she fought for a year and then we lost her in late 1975. Mm. But you know, my parents were very, very supportive. You know, when we do parades, they were always there, you know, helping with the band and bottle drives and the things we used to do for a new sousaphone or a new uniform piece or plumes for our hats and stuff like that. But, you know, those informative years, you know, when the 60s were happening with the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and Jimi Hendrix and Cream and Santana and all of those early, when Woodstock happened, this light bulb went off in my head. And I stood in line for three and a half hours to go see Woodstock at the Stanley on what street is that? Burrard. The old Stanley on Burrard, right? I think it's probably a car dealership now over there with Ferraris or something. And I came out of there and it was like my life changed.
Wow.
In 69, because I was in grade, let's see, I graduated in 72 and I was 18. So I was in grade 9, I guess. Grade 9. So, you know, I was listening to him playing to a lot of all those inspirational records, including the stuff that my parents had. So I was getting into rock and all of that era in the 60s, and my parents' music, which was, you know, Johnny Cash and Jimmy Horton and Ray Price and Pearl and Husky and Kitty Wells and all the country, and then my mom's Tom Jones and Engelbert Humperdinck and Tijuana Brass. All those records were all big influences on the drummer who I am now today. Mm. Because of all of those early influences that stayed with you as I was honing my craft, not really knowing what I was going to do in my life. When you're a kid, you don't know that you're going to be a professional drummer. I was in sports and I ran track and I liked soccer and I was a C+ student at the best of times. But I liked people and, you know, I liked the social camaraderie of school. And I think that's what I got through on, you know, my personality and outgoingness to hang with other people.
So jumping forward, because there's so much in between, and I think one of the key things that we might do, we need to see each other more often so I can actually record you and keep and transcribe and keep notes for you.
Mm.
But there's so much. But jumping forward, how long have the band been around now? Well, I have no idea. So
we formed Loverboy in 1979. Late 79, but there was a different bass player. And then he left at Christmas that year, on the Christmas break. And Scott Smith came in January of 1980. So we hadn't recorded the first record yet at Little Mountain here. So once we got the first record recorded in Canada, we were doing warm-up tours across the country with Chilliwack and Cheap Trick and different bands like that, and playing a few of little smaller venues on our own. And then Turn Me Loose came out, and Turn Me Loose broke in 1980, a month of March, out of Montreal. Chaume FM played Turn Me Loose, and it was actually Quebec, one of our strongest markets in the country. Pierre and I were talking about that on the ride today, about because we just got two new gigs in Quebec, northern Quebec this fall.
Wow.
September 30th and October 1st.
Cool.
Way up north. He says, you know, how's the crowds? I said, Quebec is always strong, Pierre, you know, like, and Montreal and Quebec City. And it, right from the beginning, they were the strongest and stayed the strongest behind the band out of all the provinces, really, in the country. But
I think
we've been going a long time.
Musically, Quebec is also very, I think of Quebec as being a very strong musical.
And more progressive.
Yeah. They love.
There was bands that sold gold and platinum records out of the province alone.
Mm.
Easy, without having any other sales in the rest of the country.
Mm.
And I'm not talking about French-speaking artists. But
right.
Right. Like Supertramp, for mm-hmm. instance, broke through Quebec in the world. Mm. Quebec broke Supertramp.
Wow.
And Quebec, that because of that strong, you know, interest in a little bit more progressive music or, you know.
So Turn Me Loose is the one that put you
from
on
the first record, yeah.
Right, and from that it just...
Yeah, we almost hit Diamond with the first record in Canada. Diamond is a million. So we got to 600,000, which is nothing to, you know, sneeze at, right? That's six times platinum. It was a brilliant first debut record. But first what came Turn Me Loose, then The Kid Is Hot. In America, once Turn Me Loose was getting heard across the border cities, like New York near Montreal, Missoula near Calgary, south of the border near Vancouver, you know, Seattle and Blaine and Bellingham, those types of close border cities were picking up on the Canadian airwaves, but they didn't have the product because we didn't have an American release. So we actually, The Kid Is Hot came out first in Canada and then Turn Me Loose. And in America, they jumped on Turn Me Loose first and The Kid Is Hot followed second because they were trying to catch the wave. So then we signed an American release. By the end of 1980, we had an American deal, and Bruce Allen and Lou Blair went to New York and cut us an American deal with Columbia Records, who we were on at the time. So, but we signed through Toronto in Canada. Mm. But I think we're still going. We're very blessed that we're still going 36 years. We took a little hiatus between 1989 and 1994. Guys wanted to do their own records. Some guys just didn't want a tour. You know, we didn't. It wasn't a bitter breakup. It was just time to park it. Radio had changed. Grunge was out. Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, all that Seattle-based rock. Radio changed. MTV changed. It was just groups like us and Foreigner and Eddie Money and Pat Benatar and Journey. Everybody just kind of took a break from what is now called classic rock, basically, you know, it's 70s, 80s classic rock. But we've been going strong since 1994, nonstop, every year.
I think that's fabulous. I mean, not a lot of bands can actually have that as a credit. Like most bands break
and have original members.
And that's true.
Excluding one. We lost Scott, as you know, in 2000. Yeah. But to have, I believe he would still be here. Because it's just the camaraderie that we've had between each other. We've managed a business and a partnership and friendships. And we have your disagreements like any marriage, right? Paul and I were at odds just like 2 weeks ago over a little thing. But little things, when you don't talk about them and get them out, turn into big things, just like any relationship, right? So you kind of got to go, you know what? We need to talk.
Yeah. Right.
Are we good? Well, once we get through the bottom of this, you know, and you do, it's like a marriage, but you know, it's your family, people that you care about, and you've been through hell and high water together, you know. But anybody would do anything for anybody in the group, you know. At this point, if the phone rang and they needed something, you would be the first to come.
And it's still as exciting every time you get on. I mean, you know, I've watched the band, and the energy is just to me as
strong.
And
we have an enjoyable time.
Because
it feels so blessed. And I think, there is synergy, exactly.
One feeds to the other, and the next thing you know, your snares are up, and they're just going with it.
And then you feed with the crowd, and they feel your good energy and your happiness. And and I, you know, as the drummer in the band, I'm kind of driving the truck, so to speak.
Yes, you are, yes.
And
you're the engine.
I take it as my personal passion to keep that energy and that newness to the songs that are almost 40 years old.
Wow.
You know? You wrote me something.
You did. Where's my glasses?
Good job. Barney High School in South Vancouver. And my girlfriend was at David Thompson, the other school down in South Vancouver. And we were sports rivals, the two schools, the two high schools. Rugby and soccer, we were rivals, but my friends seemed to be over there. So anyway, I joined a band of some older guys than me, a country group. And the singer, actually, I think it's still maybe singing in the Vancouver area, his name was Larry Bronson. And it was Larry Bronson and the Downstream. And I was much younger than everybody else. They had finished school, but they were from that area and they'd gone to David Thompson. So anyway, after grade 11, and you got your summer months, June and July. I can't remember how I ended up finding them or they found me, but I joined their band, and we went to Kitimat, and we had a month-long gig in the month of July in Kitimat at a club. And he was kind of like a Roy Orbison-type singer. We did country, and the heaviest thing we did was like Creedence Clearwater. Okay, so now I know I'm going to be late because the gig was contracted past the first day of signing in for grade 12 for school. So I phoned home, and my dad answered. And I said, "Dad, you got to get me registered for school because I'm coming back for my grade 12. It's a big year, and I've got, you know, track meets to do, and Lisa, my sister, was starting grade 8. And I want to get him home, but you're going to have to tell the school that I'm going to be there, but I'm going to be late because of this job." He said, "Well, you know, I'm not sure I agree with you. I think you should stay on the road. That's your education.
Wow.
That's your schooling." And I went, "Put Mom on the phone."
Wow.
My dad was against me coming back and finishing my high school. He wanted me to stay out there, which I fought. I was confused as a teenager. What do I do? You know.
That's amazing.
Well, it was amazing, but it was, in a way, I mean, you could look at that it was selfish. It was, you know, that I'm doing what he maybe wanted to do, and his dream was to perform live, and he thought that I should just stay out there. And then my dad only had a grade 6 education, you know, growing up in Quebec, and large family, and working in mines and logging camps and all of that stuff. So Mom came on the phone, and I said, "Mom, you got to get me registered for school. I'm coming back, but I'm going to miss it by 4 or 5 days. And I don't want the school to think I'm not going to attend." And she said, "Okay, well, you know, your dad's kind of upset." And, you know, my dad didn't talk to me for 2 months when I came home. He did not speak to me for 2 months.
That's amazing.
When I got back. And I did come back and finish my grade 12. But, you know, that's how driven he was, you know, almost to a fault, right? I mean, we worked it out, everything fate happens for reasons in life,
but
as you know.
But he was very focused on where you should be going.
Yeah.
Musically.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
But to forego your high school education stay in a country band and kid him at, you know, it's like, okay, let's get real here. I mean, when I look back at it, it was, you know, ridiculous, but, you know, when you think of it then in 1971, right? Anyway, I came back. And I finished my school, and I didn't go to college and any of that, you know. I joined a band right out of high school, and I got the gig because my dad was laying floors in Pharaoh's Retreat in Gastown.
Okay.
And actually, not my dad, a friend of his was doing the carpets in the club during the day, and they were auditioning drummers. And he phoned my dad and said, "Hey, is your kid still playing the drums?" And he said, "Yep, he's going to be the next Buddy Rich or something like this." He said, "Why?" He said, "Well, actually, they're auditioning drummers down here at this club every day and putting the carpets in and the new tiles in the bathrooms. You should get your kid down here." Well, in those days, it was 21 in BC.
Oh.
So that was a Friday. So Dad made the calls, and we went down, and we had to stand in the fire exit and listen to the band because I wasn't allowed in the club.
Wow.
Because I was 18. Well, I was 18. I turned 18 in March. And now it's coming up June, and we had just done grad party out in Langley or Abbotsford or wherever we went out, and so I was out for the summer months, and all I wanted to do was go to Penticton and hang with the rugby team and go swimming and chase girls, right? I went down on a Friday night, heard the band, they invited me to audition on Saturday. I came down, showed me a set list of the material, and said, "Do you know any of these songs?" And I knew half of them.
Wow.
From drumming in my room to records from Chicago, Santana, Carole King, James Taylor, Steely Dan.
That you taught yourself?
I taught myself
in my room
in South Vancouver. In my little insulated
room.
Yeah. On my little drum kit.
That's
on a record player. No headphones.
Amazing when you think about that.
So they said, "Pick a couple songs you'd like to play." I played 4 songs. And then they wanted to talk amongst themselves. So I went out, went for a walk down Gastown. My dad had gone to the pub. I came back, and they said, "We really like your playing.
Wow.
And what can you tell us about yourself?" I said, "I just graduated from school. I'm 18. do you have your own drums? I said, I do. And they went, what color are they? And I said, they're pink champagne sparkle. They're Ludwigs. They said, they're not black? And I went, nope. I said, all our drummers have had black drums. That's funny. I said, no, they're sparkled. They're Ludwigs. They're really, really great drums. So, what, do you have any plans? I went, no, I just got out of school. And I went, well, we'd like to come by tomorrow and pick you up at your house and start bandwood practice on Thursday in Penticton.
Wow.
I went, Penticton? That's where I want to go. And they went, well, that's where we're from.
Wow.
We have a band house there. My life took a left turn. I saw them on Friday, auditioned on Saturday, and they showed up at my door in South Van at Killarney Park with their old school bus, all converted over, with all their instruments in the back, and their camper up front. It was a 1951 Ford Mercury school bus. And I went to Penticton and started learning material. And here's something really ironic, Suji. They auditioned a lead singer that week, but I don't really remember it because I was so busy learning the songs myself. Well, it was Mike Reno.
Oh.
His name then was Mike Renosky. He auditioned lead vocals for the band.
No.
And didn't get the job. Is that synchronicity? Is that crazy?
Is that ever? I mean, that's a... It's a
full circle of how just, we're all tied in life? Six degrees of separation.
That is just amazing.
He sang in a band that was in Penticton called Synergy. And he knew Duncan and those guys because their band had already been going, the Great Canadian River Race, which is the inner tube run that goes down the canal that Greg's mom and Greg just did between Cologne and Penticton.
Oh,
that's how the name of that band came up.
Oh, wow.
Because they were from Penticton. And they had that name for like 5 years before I met them. So I joined the band and we went to Edmonton eventually and lived up there.
I'm just personally in awe that you taught yourself enough that you actually hit the audition, got hired on the spot, because I've seen your solos. I know what you do. I don't know drumming, but I look at the techniques and it's just unbelievable. Now, where do you get that? Like, where did you just keep listening? Do you listen to it and then you try to duplicate it and then you add your own? Is that the musical part of
the above.
The genius of who you are?
Yeah. It's the spirit in me and the passion,
because
but the natural ability
techniques.
That I...
mean, you use so many different techniques in your drumming.
It's from listening, following, watching. I mean, I'm not a studious drummer, and I didn't take lessons from all the greats like a lot of drummers have gone to New York
that's
and
what
studied
I mean.
And that.
You haven't.
But
so...
I've watched. I guess I have this ability to see it and absorb it. Either in video
but,
or
also
live,
hear it.
And hear it.
And hear
see,
it.
That was my key. That's what I developed in my body, was I developed an ear. And I have a very good ear.
An amazing ear.
And I taught that at a young age. That's when we play into all those records, because on those records, in Santana or Chicago or the Beatles or the Rolling Stones or the Cream, all of those are the great drummers of our times. Buddy Rich. My dad took me to see Buddy Rich live at Izzy Supper Club. I was probably 14 or 15.
Wow.
And the only reason I got in there is because they served food. And I saw the passion on the stage when Buddy Rich drummed and how he directed a band. I went, that's me. That's how I want to be. You drive it from behind. You don't need to be up front. You just... You push the group, you have the passion, you play from your heart, your soul. Yeah. I guess it's a thing that I've developed that's still part of me at the age of 62. I feel very blessed and very, you know, that I'm still going and I'm fighting through injuries, you know, but you have to do that. I mean, that's just the way it is. You know?
Well, that's what you call it. That is the passion that you had when you first picked up those bongos.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, when I saw the little bongos over there, that's how I started at five.
That
just
little set.
Just doot, 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 getting the independence on your hands and just listening to music. And my parents were always, come and play the bongos. They'd wake me up at night and they'd be having their friends over. And I would, no, I'm shy, you know. And I had a little stool that my parents and they would put it in front of the record player. And the records would drop and I would play to the music.
No.
All of those, Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brasses, those are all my master teachers. So it's not like I never did lessons. I just wasn't in a room with a teacher. But those teachers were on vinyl, right?
Yes, I hear what you're saying. I'm still, like, my jaw still drops because musically, any instrument there's technique and it needs to
that's
be taught.
That's why, see, but before YouTube and that, and I that. Said I saw Woodstock.
Well, yeah.
That was
yeah.
the first rock and roll movie that I had ever gone to see as a young man.
Yeah.
So when I saw it, I came out of there stunned. I couldn't talk because I saw Michael Shreve from Santana drumming at the age of however old he was, 17 or 18, when he drummed at Woodstock. Because Santana was a brand new band. They debuted at Woodstock in 1969 for 350,000 people.
Yeah.
And they filmed it all and recorded it all.
Yeah.
Janis Joplin was there. I mean, everybody was there.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was amazing breakouts. Jimi Hendrix was there. Canned Heat was there. And when I saw Michael Shreve that young, just going on the same color drums that I had, Pink Sparkled Ludwigs, it all tied into me. Because that was like what kids see now with YouTube, and they follow drummers on. They see them all videotaped,
yes,
right?
Yes.
That was my first really big eye-opener light bulb going off in my head. Went, that kid is playing his heart out, and his solo and soul sacrifice. He's just going around the drums, and he slows down, and he speeds it up. All of those things just embedded themselves into me.
Yeah, but you said at that time, this is what I want.
It's been an incredible path, Suji, because right. when I did my first Modern Drummer article, it was the cover story in 1984 in my birth month of March.
Mm.
And I was in New York. I flew to New York for the interview.
Mm.
And it was the cover story.
Mm.
So I was really honored. Mm. Modern Drummer at the time, still the premier drum magazine in the world.
Mm.
And you're not going to believe I was just talking about my influences, and I was talking about Michael Shreve from Santana.
Mm. Mm.
And he walked into the room to bring an article in from an interview he had just done.
Oh, God.
I was stopped. I just, and Rick Van Horn was the interviewer, and he had a tape, and he was taking notes like you are right now, and he paused the tape. He goes, "Hey, Michael, how are you?" And they're like, you know, hugging, and I'm just like sitting there going, I'm in royalty. Because my mind and my whole body just went back to Woodstock when I saw him play that. Because it wasn't on television.
Mm.
You know, there wasn't the internet.
Mm. Mm.
You couldn't just YouTube and Google up anything and pull up
hours and hours of old footage. That's right.
When Woodstock happened, it happened for the first time, and that was it. You went to the movie theater and saw it, you know?
Man,
and then he walks in the room. It was like, okay, so I'm on this incredible path, you know?
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I've been very blessed. Yeah, I should do a book. Great stories, but, you know, for me, it's about survival, you know, and sobriety and the good things that I've gone through and, you know, the fight that I've fought.
Yeah. Well, that's part of
the partnership with your buddies and my wife.
Yeah,
and
but that's part of your story,
wife.
Too.
Yeah. But I would never write a book about parties and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I put Keith Richards' book down because it was just going on.
Yeah, I couldn't finish it.
I couldn't finish it.
No.
And Patrick bought it to me for Christmas. He says, Dad, you ever finish that book?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the size of Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the third way mark, I went, okay, all these stories.
Yeah, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to know.
No. You know
I couldn't
what?
Do
I don't
it
care
either.
Anymore.
I didn't even get that far.
And that's not the kind of book that I would write.
No.
I think
there's a lot more.
Dropping names and all that.
Yes,
I've played some of the greatest concerts around the world with some of the great artists in Fleetwood Mac and all these bands, but it's the experience, you know, and the people that you've met and the concerts and, the way the band just, you know, bonded together and was always there for each other. And then,
well, all the personalities that you've come up with, they're positive events.
Yeah.
And they form part of your life.
And those people and then their families and their children,
yes,
you know, flying around in jets with Scott, with changing diapers with his two, because he had the first two kids in the band. And so, we were all Uncle Maddie and Uncle Paul and Uncle Dougie, you know, and Uncle Mike backstage, you know. And all those things are cool stories, but, you know, we've had some.
Do you know what makes your storytelling even more important? You have an incredible memory. You really do.
Yeah.
It's not everyone. I can't. Pierre can't. A lot of people that I know can't pull back and just say, 1970, whatever, and then that's when we did this, and then we went to Penticton, and it was so... You have an incredible memory.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's all just embedded in my mind. Yeah.
But it just comes rattling out.
Yeah.
You don't
I could talk.
But you're not even searching, and that's why I think that the book has to happen.
Yeah.
Because it's not the negative, it's not the big party.
And we want to get it before my memory does go and start slipping, right?
Well, yeah. You know. You're what, 60 now?
Two.
62.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're both kind of like trying to keep memories going, Pierre and I, right? I'm a little older than you, but Pierre's about 60. He's a couple of years older.
Yeah.
He's 64, I'm 67.
Wow. Yeah.
Wow. But still,
yeah.
Right? You still have way more than either one of us, and that's what's going to make the book. And you're right. It's not the horror stories and the glory of the jets and the glory of the ups and downs and the drug and the booze and all that. It's truly the essence of the value of the personalities and the stories that you've met that needs to be laid down. Because
the path and the synchronicity of how certain things happened at certain times, and you don't know why or how, but...
But
you know, how we all met. And
yeah, but your band is always will be famous. And fame has a path.
Yeah, right.
And it has to be laid down in ways that people can all... It's your legacy.
Yeah.
I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Right, you're right.
It's your legacy. And yes, the records are still in the music. I mean, but this stuff, nobody knows.
No.
That's what you got to share.
I read Eric Clapton's book, and it was like this. Because he's... dry and clean and sober.
Yes, I haven't read him.
It was brilliant. And he wrote it himself. And he did it on his Mac, traveling around. And it's not about the messy stuff. He talks a little bit about his relationship with George Harrison and how they ended up with each other's wives. But it doesn't go into gory detail. It just talks about the love that was going on in the 60s and how it just seemed they weren't meant to be with the people they were meant to be. They ended up, you know.
Yep.
But he talks about the music and the recordings and what brought some of these incredible tunes that he wrote and his guitar that he would have played.
Yeah.
Different, like the interesting stuff about the music and the creativity of it.
Right. Well, yeah.
It's not for everybody. It's not. Yeah. It's not all the gore and the.
No.
You know, it's like the Keith Richards book.
Yeah.
It's like, oh man.
Yeah.
You know, a little drier, but I enjoyed it for that reason. I really did. So I think that maybe as a blueprint, you know. I would do something closer to that.
A little closer, but I think you're going to be a little bit more colorful,
yeah.
Maddie. I can feel it in you.
Yeah.
I think there's dessert
That's
happening.
That's probably going to fill your hard drive.
I'm going to download it into my... separate one that I use.
What are you drinking? What did he make you?
I don't know. Pierre?
He's like champagne. What